Session number 9253, room 9.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, Reel 9. Could you continue the account of the parade where your old departing colonel said...
And then he introduced his successor. His successor was one of the majors. Never heard of him before, actually, because I expect he was a major in one of the other companies. He would be, because he came from the town of Alnwick. A-L-N-W-I-C-K, Alnwick. Now, his name was Scott Jackson. And Scott Jackson was our colonel who went overseas with us to Flanders. I got to know him very, very well, and I will be able to tell stories about him later.
What about your old colonel? Were you sorry to lose him? Was he sorry to go?
Never saw much of him, actually. No. The colonel, he was somewhat remote, almost. Our own platoon officer, Honourable Watson Armstrong, our own captain of the company, Captain Milburn. Oh, by the way, Captain Milburn was... He didn't go overseas with us either. He just had no farewell. They tell me that he was near broken-hearted when he was told for medical reasons he couldn't go, right at the last minute. And he never had a farewell for that reason. He was that disheartened with the fact that the company he had trained all those years, years before the war, and a local man of Ashington, and he couldn't go overseas with us. It must have upset him a tremendous lot. He never heard another word of him, even after the war.
Did it upset the men that he couldn't be in charge?
No, just, Northumbrian. And Northumbrian, as I said before, just accept anything that comes along.
Did the Camas people give you any send-off at this parade?
Oh, yeah, well, I don't know, but they were there. You see, on this parade ground, during the day, of course, and kids would be at school, I expect. Well, I don't know where they went to school, because we took a school from them. However, on that parade ground, there was these farewells, you see. Our colonel left, was bid his farewell, introducing his new colonel, and so on. And then... we marched then out of the parade ground. I remember on the parade ground, it was only our battalion there. I don't know where the other three battalions were. But we all assembled at Blythe Seaport.
There was no sort of cheering from the local population?
No, not a thing. No. We just marched off there and crossed the ferry. Had to cross the ferry, by the way, to get to Blythe Township. And then from Blythe Township, we embarked on trains, and the next thing we knew, we were at Dover.
Before we get on to when you arrived at Dover, there are two incidents which I believe you've recalled, which you'd like to record. Could you tell us about them?
Yes. It was while we were stationed at Camboys, which, as I told you, is on the coast of Northumberland, between Blythe, the town Blythe, and the village of Newbiggin-by-Sea. Well, one of our fellows, called Reed Oliver, lived at Newbiggin, and on the Saturday he had gone home and was making his way back to Camboys to be in time, of course, for the Sunday church parades and inspections. Church parades and inspections on a Sunday in the Territorial Army were a very big feature. and he would be punished if he was absent from those parades. So he was anxious to get back to Camboys, to his billet, as soon as possible, ready for the morning inspection. When he arrived at the river bank, the river was crossed by a ferry. No bridges in those days. It was a ferry boat, and the ferry boat had finished at 12 o'clock, midnight. And as the river, as the ferryman lived on the other side of the river, naturally his boat was on the other side to where Reed Oliver was. So when Reed Oliver arrived at the River Wansbeck to cross the river to get to Camboys, he had this wire rope, a single strand wire rope, crossing the river mouth, the River Wansbeck, about 200 yards it was at the width at that point, and this wire rope had to be crossed. Now, the ferryman crossed the river in his boat, which carried about 8 or 10 people, and a rope was attached from the boat to an iron ring. The iron ring was attached to the wire rope across the river so that the ferryman stood up in his boat and swung the rope and the ring on the wire rope across the river and so crossed the river. Well, when Reed Oliver arrived at the landing stage to cross the river, as I said, the ferryman had finished work for the day after midnight. So Reed Oliver simply climbed up on the wire rope, 200 yards long across this river mouth, with one leg on the wire rope and one arm on the river, and he hitched his way across that 200 yards of wire. When he was asked the next day how he managed to get across, all he could say was, "Well, it was dark, and I didn't see where I was going." Well, that's a little story which I don't know how anybody, I don't think I would have the nerve to cross the river on a wire rope hanging by one arm and one leg 200 yards. However, Reed Oliver did it. Now, the other story I would just like to tell you about was the day I tried to desert. Well, now, we were stationed at that time in Gosforth Park, as I've related before, at Gosforth Park, and was previous, of course, to going overseas. Well, we seemed to be at Gosforth Park many, many months, and no signs of getting overseas or to any part of the world where fighting was. What we wanted, remember, I was only a youngster of 21 years of age at that time, and we were anxious to get to war, because that's what we were joined up for. So, we heard, my pal and I, Mick Bell, we heard that a cycle corps was being formed in Newcastle, and they were for instant dispatch to some part of the world where fighting was. So we decided to desert the 7th Northumberlands and join the cycling corps. So we went home to Ashington, changed from our uniform, put on civvy suits, took the train from Ashington to, well, we were going to Newcastle, but instead of that, we got out at the station before Newcastle, which is called Manners North. We got out the station at Manners North and were walking up the platform to get off the platform and make our way to where the headquarters of this cycling corps was. We didn't know very much about the cycling corps, which was to be formed. However, we were moving up the platform, and lo and behold, coming towards us was our own platoon officer, the Honourable Watson Armstrong. He was our platoon officer, and of course, he knew us very, very well. although we were in civilian clothes. He was in his uniform, and he's coming towards us, and as he came to us, he stopped and looked at us. Mick Bell and I, in our civilian clothes, simply walked past him, one on each side of him, and took absolutely no notice of our own platoon officer who knew us, and who, of course, wanted to know why we were in Manners North Station in civilian clothes without a pass. He knew we hadn't got a pass because he was the person who would issue, sign the pass. We went past him, went off the platform, and then we took fright then, and we decided we wouldn't desert. So we simply went on to Newcastle Station, took a train back to Ashington, then put our uniform on and went back to camp. Went back to our regiment and behaved as if we had never been away. But on the Sunday morning, when we paraded for church parade, the Honourable Watson Armstrong, our platoon officer, came up to me and he says, "Why were you in Newcastle yesterday in civilian clothes?" I said, "I beg your pardon, sir. I was never away from the camp." He says, "I saw you in Newcastle." I says, "No, sir, you must have been mistaken." And he stood looking at me, and then he turned away, shaking his head. And that was the end of the day I tried to desert.
Were you not afraid of the consequences if you'd been caught, properly caught?
Well, no, I don't think so. No, we went to... Are you on there? No. Huh? Are we still on? Oh, no, we had no thoughts of that. What we were anxious about was to get to war. I mean, we were in the Territorial Army, and there was a war to be fought. We had been at Newcastle and Gosforth Park many, many months, far too long, and doing nothing except drill, bayonet fighting, and route marches. And so, when we heard there was a detachment of a cycle corps going to fight somewhere, we didn't know where, we decided we would join them, and that was all there was to it. I don't think we thought of any consequences at all of being caught or found out. No.
Right, getting back into the chronological mainstream, you said you just left Blyth en route for Dover. Could you continue with your story from there about the journey across to France?
Yes, we arrived at Dover just before, darkness had come on, and this would be the 23rd of April 1915. We embarked on a steamer, our battalion. I understand the four battalions and our brigade each went across in separate steamers. I remember we crossed the English Channel in perfect darkness. It told us that there was a gunboat of some kind, a destroyer, at each side of us going across the channel. But there was no lights, no sound, nothing. And we arrived at the other side in France. I have no idea what part of France it was, but I expect it to be part of France straight opposite Dover. And then we had to move from there to, we knew then, we were going to Belgium, to what they call Flanders. And so...
Did you get any sort of reception when you arrived in France? I mean, I know you don't know the town.
No reception at all. Nobody. I can't remember. We marched from the quayside, whatever part of France it was, up to a camp which was established for English soldiers. We stayed the rest of the night at this camp, and then we left the camp after breakfast in the early morning, and then we proceeded across France. I remember we, first of all, we got on some London buses, which conveyed us some miles. These London buses at that time were double-deckers, but no cover on the top deck, and they transported us across France. What part, I have no idea.
Were they still red, or had they been painted or camouflaged?
No, they were black. They were black. I remember that. The buses were all black. Then we disembarked from the buses and we embarked on a train. And we spent some hours on a train. And I understand we arrived somewhere near Messines.
Now, Messines, what were conditions like during the journey? Was it a comfortable journey on the buses and then on the train?
Well, we were all young fellas and we took everything as it came. No, I don't think I have any thoughts on whether we were comfortable or not. You must remember we were full kit, you know, full pack on our back, you know, water bottle on the right hand side, and haversack and bayonet on the left hand side, and a Lee Enfield rifle wherever we went. So we had a burden to carry all the time.
Did you get fed during the journey?
I can't remember being fed, but we must have been. What I remember next was we arrived at a farmhouse, and at this farmhouse, it was at night when we arrived, and the officers were given beds in the farmhouse itself. Their orderlies were given the outbuildings, and they had to make themselves comfortable there. I, with the orderlies, was one of them, and I had my ground sheet and one blanket in addition to all my kit, and I just slept in one of the outbuildings. The men, the fusiliers, they were the most comfortable because they slept in the barn among the hay. And they were very comfortable. I remember I hadn't been long asleep in the outbuilding when I felt a hand on my shoulder. And when I woke and looked up, the daughter of the farmer was standing over me and says, "Come." So I just got up. Of course, we slept with all our uniform on, just had our shoes off, boots off rather, didn't wear shoes, or boots off. Got on my feet, and she says, "Come." And I followed her, and we went to a cow shed where the farmer was lying alongside a cow which was being calved, and the calf was sticking half out of the cow. Its 4 feet, I remember, were tied together. The head was still in the body of the cow, and he had this rope attached to the 4 feet, and the daughter of the house and I, we lay down on the floor of the cow shed, and the three of us pulled when the old farmer told us to pull. I don't know what he was saying, of course, but I just did what they did, and we pulled when we were told to pull, and eventually the calf came out of the cow's body and a calf was born. The daughter and the farmer were then very busy cleaning up the calf and the cow. So I just went back to the outbuildings and had my sleep. Well, now, that was on the road. Those days after landing in France, we stayed in another farmhouse, but I can't much remember about that farmhouse where we stayed the second night. I remember the first night, of course, because of the incident with the cow and the calf.
What was your initial reaction then to the French and the Belgians?
Never saw much of them, you know. We never saw much of them. You see, when we were travelling, we travelled across country. We were in these London buses, and then we were by train. We were never in touch with any Belgian people. And then when I came to the farmhouse, I mean, I didn't have any words with any of the either the farmer or his daughter, just when she told me to come and so on. And the next morning, of course, our own cooks cooked breakfast, as they had done every morning on landing in France. And then we arrived. And then I remember we arrived at the town of Poperin. Now, I arrived at the town of Poperin on the 24th of April 1915, which meant that we had taken 4 days after landing in France to come through France over the border into Belgium, though we never saw no border, of course, into Belgium, and I arrived at this town of Poperin. It was just a name to us, of course.
You'd landed on April the 20th?
We landed on the 20th, and on the 24th we arrived at Poperin. And then, as we bypassed Poperin, didn't go through the town at all, went bypassed it, and there, in the distance, the sky was lit up with the German shells dropping on the city of Ypres. Now, Ypres is the pronunciation the Belgian people use nowadays, but in those days it wasn't known to the British soldiers as Ypres. It was known as Ypres. The word Ypres is a difficult word to pronounce to us in Belgium, so we simply called it Ypres. But there it was, 11 miles from Poperin, the city of Ypres, Ypres. And the sky was lit up, and we could see the German shells dropping on parts of the town. 11 miles it was between Poperin and Ypres, and that 11 miles road, straight road it seemed to us, was full of refugees coming out of the town of Ypres, making their way to Poperin. Our transport in those days, of course, was mules with a double horse, a double four-wheeled cart. And our transport was forcing its way behind the battalion, and I suppose, from what I heard, the poor refugees didn't get very much of a helping hand from our people, because they had to push on to keep up with the battalion. We, who were marching on foot past the refugees, we just made our way past. Refugees consisted mainly of old men and women and children. Got to remember that the war was in that country of Belgium, and every able-bodied man and woman were engaged in some kind of war effort, either in the forces or other items of war.
So you marched past the refugees going in the opposite direction, but your transport would have to force them off the road, would it, to get the room to go up the road?
That's what happened, yes. Yes, we saw some of that, our transport forcing these refugees.
How did they react, the refugees? Were they...
Never a sound, just mooching along there without a word. The spirit seemed to be broken. They were deprived of the home, you've got to remember, by the Germans shelling, and then we arrived.
Did they carry much of their possessions with them?
They carried, oh yes, they carried mostly bedding. There seemed to be bedding and personal things. No big furniture on that. And as well as carrying them, children as well were carrying as much as they could. They had wheelbarrows, all kinds of wheelbarrows. Some wheelbarrows, farm implement, farm wheelbarrows with two wheels, some with one wheel. And some of the wheels I noticed, I'll still remember, because it was a new country to us and we were very, very inquisitive, and some of the wheels weren't even round. They were just pieces of wood nailed together as to make it round as possible. Very rudimentary. And bicycles, all kinds of bicycles, and all seemed to be full of bedding and belongings like that. They were very, I don't know how they managed, struggling along. And there they were, struggling past us, heads down, not a word to each other and not a word to us. And we had no words for them because we had to go ahead. We were going to this town in front of us. We didn't know what to call it then, those days. But we could see it was very badly being shelled by the Germans. We arrived at Ypres and arrived in the marketplace. Not all of the town was being shelled, only parts of the town. But it seemed to us as we went through and when we arrived at the marketplace in Ypres, which is a very large square, and cobbled, and still cobbled today, by the way, cobbled, and on one side is the cloth hall, which is the municipal hall for the town or city of Ypres, and then behind it is the cathedral. As we arrived at the far opposite the town hall and cathedral, we could see the flames still burning, because the Germans had started the second battle of Ypres the day before. On the 25th or 24th, they had started bombing, and this is the 26th or 20, is it? 24th, when we arrived in Ypres, Wipers, and there across the square was the cloth hall blazing, all in ruins, cathedral behind it, and all those large buildings, hotels and large buildings, municipal buildings of all different kinds in the marketplace, around the marketplace, they were all down and blaze.
Did you realise before you saw this just how destructive modern shellfire was?
No, I'd seen it. No, we were... Well, you see, you've got to remember, too, when we arrived there, the shells were dropping in the marketplace, and shrapnel was flying all over. Shrapnel was flying everywhere, and we could see this. Well, we thought, well, this is war. We are now at war, and we are seeing war now, perhaps war at its worst. And this shrapnel was flying all over, and fellas, as we marched through past the hotel, where I've stayed in several times since the war, in this hotel, it was in ruins, four-storied building, and there, our company, Ashton & Company, we had our first casualty in the war. A piece of shrapnel struck one of our fellows called Tommy Rachel. At home, in the territorials, Tommy Rachel was our local postman. And Tommy says, I'm hit. And the fellows around him, he was only in the column. We marched in column of fours at that time. Today, the British Army marches in column of threes. But then the march in column of fours. There was four in line. I remember Tommy Rachel was in the line behind us, the line where I was. And the fellas in along with him says, oh, never mind, Tom. Come on. You're one of the Northumberlands. Let's get on. Aye, but Tom had a dropout. And the stretcher bearers came along and carted him away. We never saw Tom again. He was transported back to England, I understand. Well, we marched through.
What was your own reaction under shell fire for the first time? How did you feel?
I don't think we had any feelings, really. We were young, you know. I was only 21. And we just accepted it. It was war. That was war. That's what we had joined, and that's what we were there for. It was war, so we just accepted it.
It didn't make you nervous, then?
No, not me. I don't think anybody did. Personally, no. I didn't feel glorious about it all. I just accepted it. That's all that happened, yes. So we marched through Ypres and along what I know now as the Menengate Road, out of town, and we marched about 3/4 of a mile out of Ypres, Wipers we called it, of course, those days, out of Wipers, and then turned right. Now, when we turned right on the outskirts of Wipers, we came into a field, an ordinary grass field. Now, remember, it was black dark by then, on that 24th of April, 1915, and we lay in that field. We had all ground sheet and a blanket and full kit. We lay there that night, and our cooks made us a meal the next morning, and then we had another meal in the evening.